The Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Virginia.
Welcome to this virtual session of the Supreme Court of Virginia. And we welcome those who are joining us through a public queue, and we're glad that you're there. All right, Ayers versus Brook Road, Appellant's Counsel, Mr. Llewellyn, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Chief Justice Lemons, Justices of the Court, we're here today for de novo review of appellee's first demur and second demur to the amended complaint and second amended complaint, respectively. At the demur stage, the fundamental question is whether appellant, Foy E. Ayers, stated sufficient facts for which relief requested can be granted. The relief requested by Mr. Ayers in each of his complaints is that the 2009 confessed judgments that are the subject of this litigation be set aside as void due to the failure of service of the confessed judgment orders as mandated by Section 8.01-438. Under the general pleading requirements provided in Rule 1:4D, a pleading shall, quote, be sufficient if it clearly informs the opposite party of the true nature of the claim or defense, close quote. In his amended complaint, Mr. Ayers alleged in paragraph 5 the existence of the judgments. In paragraph 8, he alleged that he had no knowledge of the judgments until he received service of the Richmond complaint 10 years later in 2019. Richmond complaint is also referred to as the complaint to charge interest in the briefs. In paragraphs 17, 19, and 22, Mr. Ayers alleges that he was never served with the 2009 judgment orders as required by Section 8.01-438, and in paragraph 26, that the judgments are void as a matter of law. The relief requested in the amended complaint is that the judgments be held void, that they be set aside and struck from the court records. In the second amended complaint, Mr. Ayers alleged in paragraph 5 that the existence of the judgments, and in paragraphs 8, 20, and 31, that he was not served with certified copies of the confessed judgment orders, and in paragraph 21, service was not possible because he was physically in Florida at the time of the purported service in Virginia. The relief requested in the second amended complaint was that the judgments be ruled void as a matter of law, that they be set aside and vacated, and the public records marked accordingly. These allegations must be taken as true for purposes of the demurs. Based on these allegations, I submit that the complaints fully comply with the requirements of Rule 1:4D and that there can be no serious doubt as to the true nature of Mr. Ayers' claim in either of the complaints. Indeed, it is clear from appellee's memorandum in support of its demurs, as well as its brief here, that appellee is well informed of the true nature of Mr. Ayers' claim. Under the precedent of this court in Westlake Legal Group, Virginia law unquestionably affords a party the relief requested by Mr. Ayers if the confessed judgment orders were not served on him within the 60-day period required by Section 438. I would note that Westlake is the only Virginia Supreme Court case addressing Section 8.01-438. In both complaints, appellee elected to challenge them by demurring to the sufficiency of Mr. Ayers' pleadings. However, appellee argues now without the benefit of evidence, and as it did in the trial court, what is effectively an unfiled plea and bar based on the limitation period contained in Section 8.01-433. Interestingly, at the first demur hearing, Judge Ellis suggested to appellee's counsel that a plea and bar was needed to resolve the dispositive issue of service. This can be seen in the joint appendix beginning at page 293 in the transcript beginning at line 17. Despite the trial court's pointed comments that a plea and bar would be more appropriate than a demur, appellee elected again to file a demur to the second amended complaint, clearly wanting to avoid any examination of the evidence on the question of service. In short, appellee wants the court to decide the case in the context of a plea and bar while depriving Mr. Ayers of an opportunity to present evidence on the issue of service. aside from the fact that Section 8.01-433 cannot be applicable if the facts alleged are true, and because appellee did not posture its defense by way of plea and bar, the trial court erred when it sustained both demurs on the basis of the limitation period in Section 8.01-433. Again, the only question on demur is whether Mr. Ayers alleged sufficient facts for which the relief requested is available under Virginia law. In order to trigger the 21-day limitation period in Section 8.01-433 and satisfy the requirement of Section 8.01-438 for service of, quote, a notice setting forth the provisions of Section 433, close quote, appellee relies exclusively on the 2019 service of the Richmond complaint. This reliance, however, is misplaced for the following reasons. First, the second page of the form containing the provisions of Section 433 is absent from the Richmond complaint. This can be seen in the joint appendix at pages 338, 343, and 348. Further, if a notice setting forth the provisions of Section 43 had been included in the Richmond complaint, it was 10 years too late. Pursuant to Section 8.01-438, the provisions of Section 433 shall be appended to the judgment orders. Because the 433 notice had to be appended to the judgment orders, it had to be made within the 60-day period as service of the judgment orders themselves. So any notice given in 2019 is simply a decade too late. Moreover, this court, quoting Barnes v. American Fertilizer Company with approval, held in Singh v. Mooney that void judgments, quote, may be impeached directly or collaterally by all persons anywhere at any time or in any manner. Appellee's reliance on Section 433 is equally misplaced because Mr. Ayers' complaints do not allege a defense or set-off relating to the creditor's notes that underlie the confessed judgments. Therefore, Section 433 is not a mechanism or means to challenge a post-judgment failure of service, even assuming, one, the Richmond complaint actually included notice of the provisions of Section 8.01-433, and two, assuming the Richmond complaint was served within the mandatory 60-day period, neither of which happened. And Singh clearly permits Ayers to bring his claim as, when, and where it is brought. The court recognized in Westlake that confessed judgments are extraordinary remedies, holding that the provisions of Section 438 are self-executing. Mr. Ayers repeatedly and unambiguously alleges he was not served at any time, in any manner, at any location with the confessed judgment orders. Taking these allegations as true, as we must on demur, the judgments became void by operation of law under the self-executing language in Section 8.01-438, which reads, quote, the failure to serve a copy of the order within 60 days from the date of entry thereof shall render the judgment void as to any debtor not so served. I submit there's no clear statement of the law to be found anywhere in the Code of Virginia. The provision requiring, this provision requires nothing more than failure of service to render the judgments void. Because the statute is self-executing, there is nothing that Mr. Ayers needed to do, and there is nothing more that had to occur for the judgments to become void at the expiration of the 60-day period without service. This is the inescapable holding in Westlake, which I submit is as clear and unmistakable as the language in Section 438 stating that judgments are void if not served within 60 days. Mr. Ayers' position is further supported by Section 8.01-326, wherein the General Assembly mandates that, quote, no return shall be conclusive proof as to service of process. The clear effect of this statute is that when service is challenged, as here, an evidentiary proceeding is both permitted and required to determine the truth on the question of service. Appellee strains to argue by inference that the court should ignore the allegations in the complaint and instead should, in effect, accept as conclusive proof the returns of service filed by the judgment creditor's private process server. That is, appellee wants the court to treat the returns as a verity in direct contradiction to Section 8.01-326. Doing so ignores the plain language of the statute, as well as the revisor's note stating that, quote, Section 8.01-326 alters the former case law abolishing the anachronistic verity rule. Continuing, the revisor's note states, this section, quote, overrules the line of cases represented by Caskey v. Durham. Appellee argues that substantial compliance is all that is needed for Section 8.01-438. However, this court in Westlake held that best judgment statutes must be strictly construed, at least to the extent that they are in derogation of common law. And substantial compliance, if substantial compliance is applicable at all to Section 438, this standard cannot be squared with the plain language of Section 438 mandating that a judgment is void if not served within 60 days, nor can such standard be squared with the corresponding holding in Westlake, again, that the judgment is void if not served within 60 days. I submit that the 60-day service requirement is inviolate and not susceptible to the notion of substantial compliance, as is the requirement to append to the judgment order a notice of the provisions of Section 433 when served on the judgment debtor. I do agree that a private process server is an officer within the meaning of Section 8.01-433. However, I do not agree that an officer can use an intermediary, such as an attorney, the creditor's attorney, to make his return to the clerk. The General Assembly seems to afford the clerk latitude when stating in Section 8.01-438 that, quote, it shall be the duty of the clerk to cause to be served upon the judgment debtor a certified copy of the order so entered, close quote. Whereas the same latitude is lacking when the legislature used more restrictive language respecting the officer, stating that, quote, the officer who serves the order shall make return thereof, close quote. Given the different language used for the clerk versus the officer, I submit that the legislature intended a more direct burden, a different and more direct burden on the officer than that for the clerk, which is consistent with safeguarding the protections intended by the 60-day service requirement for the judgment order and the provisions of Section 8.01-433 notice. I will be pleased to address any questions that the court has for me. If there are none, I would like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
2 minutes and 39 seconds.
Thank you.
Mr. Moore?
May it please the court, Timothy Moore of Spotsvein PC for the Appellee Brook Road LLC. Thank you for the opportunity to appear and address the court on the issues on appeal today. The court here is presented with questions regarding carefully constructed statutory scheme that balances the rights, duties, and obligations of judgment creditors on the one hand with those of judgment debtors while preserving the concepts of due process and finality of judgments. In this appeal, the appellant is asking the court to read the statutes in a manner that does not recognize the General Assembly's intent to protect and preserve these rights and is not affording him a remedy. However, in this appeal, Mr. Ayers is conflating the lack of defense with a lack of remedy under the ruling of the circuit court. Instead, upon examining the statutes, it becomes apparent, as the trial court held, that nothing within their provisions offends concepts of due process or finality of judgments, and that the trial court properly sustained the demurs.
Mr. Moore, this is Justice Kelsey. May I interrupt with a question?
Yes.
As you know, under 438, the statute reads, the failure to serve a copy of the order within 60 days from the date of entry thereof shall render the judgment void. Your opponent alleges that there was a failure to serve a copy of the order within 60 days. What more is there to this argument?
Your Honor, to be sure I understand you saying that because the allegation is no service, that ends the inquiry, because if it is correct, it violates 8.0 and 438?
Yeah, if void means void ab initio, as opposed to voidable, why isn't his argument that simple?
Because these, unlike the Westlake Legal Group matter, these are facially valid judgments. The record in the underlying cases shows that there was personal service on Mr. Ayers within 60 days of the confession of judgment. Therefore, while this court said that 8.01438 is self-executing, it can't be self-executing if, in fact, the face of the underlying judgments shows that service was obtained. Instead, in order to seek to have the judgments vacated on the basis of a claim of lack of service, Mr. Ayers seeks to impeach that evidence in the underlying case in a collateral attack. And this court has ruled that the verity of the records in the underlying judgments are free from impeachment on a collateral attack. And as counsel for the appellant noted, there is 8.01326, which makes reference to the Caskey case that's cited to by both parties. But that is not, that did not do away with the verity of the records in an underlying case. What that did away with was the ruling in Caskey that did not allow a sheriff's return to ever be impeached unless it could be shown that the person that obtained the service participated or procured the fraud. It is not the it did not abrogate or get rid of the doctrine of the verity of records, which was upheld as recently by this court in the Trans-Dulles case that we cited, where the court found that a default judgment affords an absolute verity. And because 8.01326, it says that the return of service of process by a private process server is evidence of what is contained therein, the underlying confessions of judgment contain evidence that the creditor complied with 8.01438 and that they are not void judgments.
So there's no way to contest it? Because he comes in and says it's just not factually true. It didn't happen. I don't know why they signed it the way they signed it. I don't know what they did. I was there. What didn't happen? Is there no way to contest it?
There is a manner to contest matters with a confession of judgment, and that was clearly established by the General Assembly with 8.01433. And in 8.01433, what the General Assembly was trying to do with these confession of judgment statutes was to balance the rights and duties of a judgment creditor with the rights and duties of a judgment debtor. And so 8.01438 requires that the judgment creditor, after confession of judgment, to make efforts to put the judgment debtor on notice by obtaining service within 60 days. Once the judgment creditor has obtained service on the judgment debtor within 60 days, it knows it does not have a void judgment, and then it can move forward. And as noted by this court in Westlake, where there was a not found in the return of service, the judgment creditor should have known it was void and couldn't pursue post-judgment remedies. However, once the creditor does obtain service, it knows the judgment is not void and it may pursue post-judgment remedies. And so then 8.01433 gives rights, but also places obligations on a judgment debtor. And the rights of that are placed on that judgment debtor is that they have 21 days from when they have notice of the judgment. And it's important that the General Assembly use different words in 8.01438 and 8.01433. In 8.01438, it speaks of service. In 8.01433, it speaks of notice. And so the General Assembly intended something different. And so the protection that is afforded to the judgment debtor, and it protects due process rights, is that under 8.01433, A judgment debtor has 21 days from when it has noticed that the judgments have been entered against him. That is all that the statute says, is notice that the judgments have been entered against him to move to set aside that judgment. And so the remedy that was available here was to pursue a motion to set aside in the confessions of judgment within 21 days after receiving notice that the judgments were entered against him. And the reason why the court was able to decide this issue on demur is because it is clear from both the amended complaint as well as the second amended complaint that Mr. Ayers pleads and alleges notice, actual notice of those judgments more than 21 days prior to the filing of the complaint. And so on the face of the pleadings, this court, or the trial court, properly decided the demur. So the General Assembly did not leave Mr. Ayers without a remedy in this case. Mr. Ayers did not avail himself of this remedy. And this court has recently, in the Bonanno case that it decided in May of this year and issued an opinion, has given some clarity on some of these issues as it relates to void judgments and attacking void judgments. And as this court said in the Bonanno v. Quinn case, that the language that a void judgment may be challenged by all persons anywhere at any time or in any manner is not an accurate reflection of the law and is not to be construed as an unfettered ability in any manner to attack an order as void ab initio. And instead, this court said, quote, a challenge that an order is void ab initio, even for lack of subject matter jurisdiction, may be raised only in a valid, direct, or collateral proceeding where the voidness of the order is properly at issue. So that raises the question. There are three claims that are here under appeal, count one and count three of the amended complaint, and then the second amended complaint. And so were those claims proper manners for attacking the judgments here? And under Virginia law, they were not. In Bonanno, this court recognized the following remedies that you could for attacking a void judgment. One would be to simply await an enforcement proceeding and seek to defend on that basis. That is what happened in Westlake. That is not what has happened with these complaints. The second is to challenge it with a declaratory judgment action. That too is not what happened with these claims, as because counsel for the appellant argued in both the trial court and in his briefing here that he is not asserting a declaratory judgment action here. The third manner that is suggested by the court in Bonanno is to file a motion to vacate or set aside by a party in the proceeding to which the judgment was entered, which would in this case have been under 8.01.433, but that too is not what happened here. But this court has also recognized that Virginia Code Section 8.01.428D preserves the independent cause of action in equity to relieve a party from a judgment.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey again. Why can't a party who's complaining about a void judgment just say when a void judgment is presented for execution, but this is void, Judge? Why do you have to go through the other drills if the charge is being made against the party and the defense, so to speak, is not to the merits, but you can enforce this? It's a void judgment. That seems like a pretty good way to do it, isn't it?
Well, this court did recognize that you could do that and recognize it in the Bonanno case, for instance, and it occurred in the Westlake case, but it must be a void judgment. And so this judgment is facially valid. The confession of judgment on its face, and the record is clear, it shows that the appropriate confession of judgment language was contained in the debt instruments, that the duly appointed attorney in fact appeared in the circuit court clerk's office and confessed judgment, and that the records show and the evidence is that they were served within 60 days. So because they are facially valid, as this court stated in Bonanno, you have to be able to make an appropriate challenge to that. And it cannot be a collateral attack because of the verity rule, because you're attempting to dispute the the evidence in the underlying case. And so it needs to be procedurally proper and be a direct attack, which would be a direct attack under 8.01.433. And so I'd like to just address some of the claims as well very quickly, because there are three particular claims. The first is the count one of the amended complaint under 8.01.428A. And the statute is clear that section applies only to default judgments and decrees pro confesso. And this court has held that under Shockett v. Silverman that a confession of judgment is not that. Additionally, that requires that a motion be brought in the case, so the court properly dismissed that. Count three alleges a violation of due process, asserting that jurisdiction was not obtained because of the allegations of lack of service. However, as this court has stated in the Pate v. Southern Bank and Trust Company case, jurisdiction is obtained through the attorney of fact appearing in the clerk's office rather than through the service of process. And there are no allegations that the confession of judgment statutes violate due process. And so count three was properly dismissed by the trial court. And then as the second amended complaint that I think brings us back more to your questions, Justice Kelsey, which is, can that be an attack? And I would submit that, again, as this court said in Bonanno, the far-reaching language of the ability to attack a judgment is not as broad as it was stated in that case, and that is not the law in Virginia, and you must have an appropriate procedure. And so if the second amended complaint necessarily must have been a claim under 8.01.428D, and that necessarily fails because a necessary element under 8.01.428D is a defense to the underlying cause of action, which is language that is different than 8.01.433. And the appellant is clear in his briefing that he asserts no such defense. So the second amended complaint was properly dismissed by the circuit court. I believe that it's very important that the General Assembly's intent of protecting and affording the rights to the judgment creditor as well as the judgment debtor here are what the trial court found and what the appellee here is arguing. I think, and the other thing is, there's a lot of reliance on the Westlake case, and the Westlake case clearly says, it says simply that 8.01.438 is intended to afford a debtor a limited opportunity to have a day in court to assert a defense to the creditor's claim. It does not say that you simply have an opportunity to come in and contemplate a situation here where you assert no defense to a creditor's claim, but instead are able to just assert a technical defense on procedure that a facially valid judgment is void.
And Mr. Moore, your time has expired. Mr. Llewellyn, you have 2 minutes and 39 seconds remaining for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Counsel discussed whether or not our inquiry would end the case by simply alleging that there was no service. And I would submit to the court that that's actually the beginning of the inquiry in this case. Once we have alleged that there was no service, we are challenging the very essence of this judgment. All of what counsel is talking about is form over substance. We came before the court. We made sufficient allegations to state a claim. We're here on demur. And the question is whether or not we have put the appellee on notice of what the true nature of our claim is and whether or not relief is available under Virginia law for the claim that we're stating. And I submit that it's very clear that Virginia law through Westlake does make it clear that we do have the relief that is being requested. And I don't believe there can be any serious doubt of what the nature of our claim is. If the appellee's position is taken, then we might as well remove 8.01-326 from the Code of Virginia, because it has no meaning. It would mean nothing at all if you can't go in and challenge a return of service. I mean, that's exactly what the language in 801.4326 says. No return shall be conclusive proof as to service of process. Well, if that's true, how do you challenge that? Now, counsel has suggested that we can do it through 801.433. Of course, that requires notice of the provisions of 433, and those provisions have to be provided within the 60-day period. But in this particular case, if we look at the record, which is what Appelli is relying on, we know that on those pages that I cited in the appendix, the notice of the provisions of 433 were not included in the Richmond complaint. Further, we know that it was 10 years after the fact, not within the 60-day period. And further, the challenge being made here is not one of a defense or set-off to the underlying notes on which the confessed judgment notes were, or judgments were rendered. Likewise, with 8.01-428D, you have to have the same basis, or you need to allege the same basis, or a basis to attack the underlying note or debt instrument upon which judgment was obtained. That's not what we're doing here. It's very clear all we are seeking is to set aside the judgments on the basis of the fact that they were not served within the 60-day period, and therefore they are void ab initio, as the statute says.
Thank you. All right, Mr. LeBlanc, your time has expired as well. The clerk will call the next case.